Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here, as usual, with Russ Chiannelli. And today we've got a guest from the University of California at Riverside who is actually very interested in what we call condensed matter. Now, condensed matter can be diamonds, it can be sand, there's hard condensed matter, there's soft condensed matter, and then there's sort of intermediate matter. And Russell, who's going to be our guide in this condensed materials matter?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Chung-Ning Lau, who we will call Jeannie here on the show. She's a professor of physics at the University of California in Riverside. Welcome to Science Studio, Jeannie.
Thank you, Rush. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about, first of all, with such a name, you clearly you were born in China, all right? That much I can ascertain. And then I know you moved to Hong Kong.
That's right.
Now, we want to know how it was you became a scientist, not how you specialized in condensed matter, but what were those little things when you were a little girl in Hong Kong or in China that said to you, ha, this is an avenue for me?
That's a good question. I actually always wanted to be a writer when I was a little kid. And in Hong Kong, you actually to choose the branch. You need to decide to pursue artistic branch, so meaning writing, history, science branch at grade 9. So my family actually thinking the artists will always starve, forced me to choose the science branch, which I did. So that's actually how I get to become a scientist.
So this is sort of going into the British tradition of education.
That's right.
About 16, your parents and your teachers make up your mind for you.
That's
right?
Correct, yes. But once I get into it, I got into it reluctantly. But as probably any good Chinese, dutiful Chinese daughter or son, you know, you do things even though you don't want to do it. But once you actually started, I started taking the physics classes, chemistry classes, I actually start to really enjoy them. I actually find it amazing how the universe can be described by a few simple equations. Well, little do I know that's probably not true, but from what I learned back then, I think it's just amazing how the operation of the universe can be described by a few simple equations, and that unifies all the things we see around us.
At least all the things we know to this date.
To date, yes.
Right.
Of course, there's many things that we don't know, and it is this, I think, the drive to understand the nature around us, this curiosity that they can actually be understood, I think that fascinates me.
Of course, now we've had several recent guests that tell us, oh, we used to have a simplified equation for the universe, no more. But let me ask you a question. When you wanted to write, what did you want to write about?
You know, I think I was just interested in writing. I think I want to maybe write novels. I want to write essays, maybe even poems. I was pretty good, well, by the standard of, 12-year-old or something.
Do you still do it as a hobby?
Now I write proposals, papers, reports, recommendation letters every day.
Right. Tell us a little bit about what you said, novels. Can you remember then when you were in this developmental age, mm-hmm. what sort of novels? Did you read Chinese literature predominantly or British literature or what?
I write very extensively. So lots of Chinese literature and also translated foreign literature from Russia, from America, from Britain.
Okay.
So I was quite an avid reader.
Did you have a favorite author in those days?
English book did you read?
Well, we read Jane Austen, Hemingway.
Well, that's good. The one thing I would say is that there aren't many people listening to this program that grew up in America that have read very many Chinese novelists. Maybe the odd Russian, and then that's usually Tolstoy and Dostoevsky. Right. Maybe Nabokov, all right, but not so much. Anyway, so that your parents and your teachers grafted you into the science.
But then you left
Hong Kong to come and study in North America. Tell us, where did you study and mm-hmm. how did you make those choices?
Yes, so I went to University of Chicago for my Bachelor of Science degree. And so that's when I chose to study physics. So actually have very good scores. Top of the class, my parents actually really wants me to become a doctor or a lawyer. And that's what most of my classmates do in Hong Kong, actually. But then I actually resisted when I was 18. I feel like I can make the decision myself now. I actually really wanted to study physics. That's where I decided to major in physics.
And University of Chicago is an outstanding physics group.
That's right.
Right.
Yes.
Did you do any undergraduate research when you were there as an undergraduate in Chicago?
Yes, actually, quite extensively. I worked with maybe three different research groups, starting from freshman year. But first one was with astrophysics group. Astronomy is such a fascinating topic. You learn about the stars, which live and die billions of years ago. Then I quickly learned that that's not for me. And then I joined the group of Professor Sid Nagel. So what he specializes in is so-called the physics of breakfast table. It's actually a very fun lab. For example, he will study how when you drip honey, how they come down and they make a little spiral. So physics of that, you drop a little piece of water and how it splatters on the surface. And how it splatters depends actually, for example, on the wind, on the atmosphere, or whether it's vacuum or not, on the surface. Right. It's actually lots of physics at that.
I mean, that's like when you read about Isaac Newton and all that. He was doing that kind of breakfast right. physics.
So what I my own project at the time was to how to study the so-called granular material. It's actually a fancy name for sand, how sand pack under vibration. So we fill up a column, a glass column with sand. We fluff it up with some air. And so the sand is settled to a certain height. And you shake it once, the height will decrease a little. You shake it again, it will decrease again. So we study how the height changes the number of vibrations as the vibrations, how hard you shake it, and what frequency you shake it. And then we change the size of the sand, the shape of the sand.
So it's getting more packed because the bigger pieces are going to the bottom? Or
the bigger piece actually will rise to the top. It's actually called the Brazil nut phenomenon.
The Brazil nut phenomenon.
That's right. So if you have a jar of mixed nuts, you start shaking it, you'll see the bigger nuts will go to the top.
Ah.
That's actually how I shake it to get my favorite piece of pecan.
That sounds like
nut
departmental
peanuts.
Politics. The
yeah,
biggest
yeah,
nuts
right.
always come to the top. This is very. I remember as a student at about 13 going to the Royal Society in London. We had a demonstration from Lawrence Bragg, who was the person who made the Bragg equations for X-ray diffraction. And he had this big, big container of sand. And then he pressed a button, and then it was agitated, but they had air flowing through it. And up popped a duck. I mean, obviously a toy duck, and sort of floated on the top.
Right.
And I've always remembered that.
Oh,
that was
yeah,
just
yeah,
totally
yeah.
fascinating. But sand is a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun, yeah.
And did you
yes.
publish some breakfast physics papers?
Well, I was a co-author, of course. I was
yes.
just helping the graduate student at the time to do experiments. So I was co-author of the paper.
Okay, yeah, that's lovely. And then after an undergraduate degree in would that be called soft matter or
that
hard
would be
matter?
The soft matter.
That's soft matter. So then you moved on to graduate school.
Yes, at Harvard University.
At Harvard. So your pedigree is quite good.
Oh.
Sort
okay.
of an English-style education followed by Chicago and Harvard. Not too bad.
Okay.
What did you do at Harvard?
So at Harvard, I actually joined Professor Tinkham's group. He's a specialist in superconductivity.
And so what did you learn about superconductivity in your thesis?
So what I study is superconductivity in a very small wire, very thin wire. So superconductivity is actually a bulk phenomena. You see superconductivity in big chunk piece of metal, for example. So the question is, if you reduce a big chunk of metal to very small dimension, say to a thin film, or in my case, to a very small wire, will superconductivity be still there? Or will it go out? Or if it goes out, what will be the criteria for it to disappear? So what I do is I take a very... So nanotube by the time just came out. So I take a piece of little strand of nanotubes, carbon nanotubes, so suspend it across a trench and deposit the superconducting material on top of that. So that will give me nanowires with diameter of about 5 to 20 nanometers. And so I will measure the resistance of these nanowires and see how they behave as a function of temperature. And so for thicker nanowires, no problem. They become superconducting, resistance drops to zero. And for thinner ones, they actually stop become superconducting.
So let's, for our audience out there, when you're measuring the resistivity, what happens is when it's a superconductor, it goes to zero.
That's correct.
It's not resistance. And the other thing is you're saying as you make the particles smaller, the superconductivity disappears. So the nano superconductors don't work.
That's right. That's one of the interesting questions. So when will superconductivity disappear? And so this will competing with some other mechanisms. So superconductivity is actually a many-body phenomenon, meaning it involves the movement of many electrons all at once. So the question is how does that break down? And so when you make things very, very small, then the Coulomb repulsions, that is this repulsive interaction between the electrons, will start to become stronger. Then that's why superconductivity eventually breaks down.
I mean, this relates to a program we just did a couple of weeks ago on the Planck scale of physics,
yeah.
That when you get small enough to the Planck scale, modern physics stops, and there's a whole new type of physics that comes into play.
And you get many black holes.
Yeah, yeah, but that's a much smaller length scale than what
I understand, but it's en route.
That's right.
But give us a feeling here, you know, if you had a single crystal sitting on the table, you know, it was a couple millimeters, and then you make it smaller. When do you see changes that tell you that these Coulomb positive attractions are changing everything?
Oh, you have to make them a lot smaller, say a nanometer.
Yeah, okay.
So
they have to be as small as a nanometer?
Well, roughly about 10 nanometers.
10 nanometers, which is 100 angstroms.
It's about 100 angstroms.
Okay, so that's pretty small.
So
that's really a nanomaterial.
That's about, you can pack maybe, say, 30 atoms across a wire of this diameter.
Well, if you go bigger, is this a sharp transition or a gradual, if you were 1,000 angstroms or 100
That's
nanometers?
A very good question. So what we see is actually a crossover. So it's a gradual transition. So superconductivity disappears slowly. So at first, it just resistance decreases very quickly to zero. If you reduce the diameter of the wire, it then decreases slowly to zero, and then decrease diameter of wire some more, it stays almost constant. It decreases some more, then it becomes insulating, meaning the resistance will start to increase with decreasing temperature.
Yeah, so we can forget about superconducting nanomaterials and work on extended solids, condensed solids.
that's right. So the implication of research is just that there is a limit to how small you can make a superconducting circuit. For example, if you want to make superconducting circuits maybe for cell phone towers, superconducting supercomputers, perhaps even quantum computers based on superconductivity, then there's a limit to how small you can make them. So that's perhaps a little bit practical implication.
You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Jeannie Lau from the University of California at Riverside, talking about very small materials and what they do and don't do. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. When I see Magic Johnson, I marvel at the powerful HIV medications available today. He's still a strapping 6'9", even though the former basketball player has lived with HIV for over 20 years.
While the AIDS cocktail is a powerful mix of drugs, unfortunately, it is not a cure because there's a hidden pool of HIV-infected cells that keeps the virus in the body.
If scientists could activate these cells somehow, they might have a shot at eradicating them. Well, a group of researchers just found a way.
It helps to understand that when HIV infects CD4-positive T white blood cells, a copy of its genetic information is permanently inserted into the cell genome. Ironically, CD4-positive T white blood cells are what fight off viral infections in our body.
When some of these infected T cells revert to a resting state, the virus inside goes dormant. Anytime these infected T cells are reactivated, the virus inside triggers a whole new round of infection. That's why HIV patients stay on drugs for life.
In the new study, a drug called Xalinza showed it could activate these dormant cells. Researchers gave Xalinza to 6 HIV-infected men on drug therapy.
They all showed a 5-fold increase in the amount of HIV in their cells. This means the latent HIV were activated, making it more likely that the immune system will kill off these infected cells.
If you're wondering whether the extra HIV production in the cells made the patient sicker, it didn't, because the viral load in the blood did not go up. They were all on HIV drug therapy. This latest discovery offers for the first time in years a real shot at a cure for AIDS.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russell Chianelli, Jeannie Lau from the University of California, Riverside. Before we took a break, we were going through your studies of taking superconducting materials on nanotubes of carbon and getting smaller and smaller sizes. And then at some stage, the superconducting properties of the material on the carbon tubes vanished.
That's right.
At a small size. Does it make any difference what the substrate is, for example? You're using carbon nanotubes. Suppose you used some silicon or molybdenum oxide or some other nanotube. Does it make any difference?
That is a very good question. I think on one hand, it does not make, it should not make a huge difference. On the other hand, the substrate that does provide so-called screening, dissipation mechanism. So there will be details about when this transition will happen. So that will make a difference in that sense.
But not a macro difference.
It's not
that you're going to one day find these nanomaterials which are superconducting.
That's right.
But let me ask you this question. Do you think it's possible that someday, as you make the particle smaller, you'll cause an electronic change that'll make it a superconductor?
That's a very interesting question. Instinct is to say no, but then in this business, I learned to say never, so that I think everything's possible. The nature usually has so much surprise for us.
I know, because we really want to talk about some graphene work that you're doing, too, but when I was at this conference with all the big theorists there, they really can't explain the high-temperature superconductors. They're having great difficulty.
That's right. For the past 35 years, there's no consensus about how superconductors.
So maybe there are some surprises waiting for us.
No, there are a lot of surprises. So the recent discovery of iron-based superconducting material is a big surprise, because normally a magnetic field or a ferromagnetic material will quench or suppress superconductivity, but in this case, you actually have superconductivity in a magnetic material. So that's a huge surprise.
Let's then get on to the graphene.
Okay.
Graphene is one of these new materials that everybody's interested in, thin films, almost one atom thick of carbon. Tell us about how you make them, what your interest in these materials is.
Okay, so what we make them is this so-called mechanical exfoliation, which is the fancy name for rubbing. So this technique is also called Scotch tape technique, and this is pioneered by the group at Manchester. So what you do is you take a piece of nitrile graphite, and you use Scotch tape to peel it off into little pieces.
Because it's layered,
each layer is very loosely bound to each other. Then you press the Scotch tape onto a silicon wafer, and then peel off the Scotch tape, and then voila, you have many graphene or little thin graphite flakes. And you can actually see the single layer graphene, so single atomic layer, and the optical microscope.
So the implication is that the silicon wafer is stickier for the carbon monolayer than the Scotch tape, right? Otherwise, when you peel off the Scotch tape, the graphene layer would come with you. So what is it that holds the carbon graphite layer onto the silicon?
So it is a van der Waals force. So I actually won't say it's stickier. What's happening is that on the Scotch tape, you actually probably have very thin graphite films. Say maybe you have 100 layers.
It just peels it.
Right, but you want to press it onto the silicon substrate, you will have, so when you, then you peel it off, so probably you're leaving maybe 50 layers, sometimes maybe one layer or two layers on the substrate.
So it's a bit hit and miss.
It is a random process.
You're not going to be doing this on a regular basis and getting uniform films.
Right, not the way I'm doing it, but there are a lot of researchers who develop techniques to make a large, very large area, single layer graphene.
Okay, but we should say that graphene is a single layer of graphite.
Yes. Graphene is single layer graphite, so the atoms are arranged in the honeycomb lattice. I really think it's really amazing, a wonderful material. You can imagine this is a single layer of atomic membrane. It's very, very strong. It's stronger than steel. It can sustain huge strain. You can sustain more than 25% of strain. So by comparison, for example, most material can sustain maybe a fraction of a percent. And it's very soft, too. So it's like a very soft piece of silk.
So it's flexible? Is that why?
It's very flexible. Yeah. It's very bendable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't take much to bend it. Mm-hmm. So it's strong and soft at the same time. It has very high thermal conductivity, much better than copper, 20 times better than copper, probably 1,000 times better than silicon. It has very high electrical conductivity, at least 100 times better than silicon. And then it's also transparent. So you look around, you're right, most insulating material are transparent. Or conductors like metals are opaque. But graphene is actually one of those rare materials that both excellent conductor and transparent.
So therefore, it should be in solar cells.
Yes, that's one of the major applications for as a transparent electrodes for LCD liquid crystal displays, solar cells, touch screen, for example.
So it lets the light in, but it can still conduct the electrons out.
That's exactly right.
So what are you doing with these materials? What's your particular aim and your particular research topic?
What I do is actually I do transport spectroscopy. So this is, again, a fancy jargon for saying I measure the resistance of these materials at low temperature. As a function of, say, magnetic field, electric field, temperature, et cetera, et cetera. So what I want to find out is actually find out the intrinsic electronic properties of graphene. So what I aim for is to get the highest quality material we can. We do that by actually suspending them, so making them into freestanding, single or two-layer thin films.
So explain that, or you should explain it. So you're mm-hmm. doing exfoliation in liquid?
No, actually, we exfoliate this rubbing technique.
With a rubbing technique. Right?
So this is very much
so
like...
So instead of scotch tape, you're rubbing mm-hmm. them off into thin layers.
That's right. So it's like when you write with a pencil on the paper, you actually will probably get some graphene. You just won't see it on paper.
So when you're making these thin films, well, these monolayers, if you're lucky, you're looking at various properties of transport,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
So... given what we know about carbon, it forms van der Waals, weak interactions with other organic sort of varieties, then these properties are going to be very dependent upon the environment that you study them in. If you study them in vacuum or you study them in a hydrocarbon environment, so they could be interesting sensors at some stage, I would imagine.
Oh, that's exactly right. You've already predicted it. So, yes, there's a lot of people developing them as chemical and biological sensors because they are very sensitive to the environment. The claim is that they can sense less than the transfer of one electron charge.
That's pretty sensitive.
That is very sensitive.
Right.
Yeah.
Perhaps too sensitive, right? Because, I mean, you can have material that is so sensitive that it's impossible to distinguish one cause of the sensitivity from another.
Right. So if it's too sensitive, you can fix it by, for example, functionalizing, meaning adding some chemical groups to the surface so that the chemical group will have the receptors for the molecule you want to detect. That will have the specificity. You can detect specific molecules.
Are you doing that type of research?
No, we're actually not doing that. We collaborate with Professor Robert Hedden, which is a professor of chemistry at Riverside. So they are doing that kind of research. We will help them to study the properties of those sensors.
The graphene single layers are two-dimensional. Is it possible to have a two-dimensional superconductor?
That's another really good question. I think that's one of the really frontier of the field is to try to dope graphene to see if they can become superconductor, or is it possible to have a two-dimensional superconductor, a single atomic layer superconductor? You know, that would be, I would say, very fascinating.
Well, you say doping. You're talking about putting another metal in?
Okay. So I would say doping meaning increase the charge density of graphene to a very high density. So either by putting some metallic atoms on the surface or by using the so-called ionic gating, putting some ionic liquid on the surface so that it can the ionic liquid transfer some charge to graphene that increase charge density that way.
You mentioned the word membrane earlier. Tell us a little bit about then these graphenes. Let's just take the one layer. What types of molecules, in fact, are they permeable to? Does oxygen move through? Does
no,
anything go through?
Nothing goes through.
So it's not a membrane in that sense.
It is
yet.
It is impermeable membrane. So
right.
It's actually. I think there are some groups in Spain that are actually trying to make a huge helium balloons using graphene.
I like the words impermeable membrane because it sort of. That's a sort of a non sequitur to me. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. Because
well,
I always
why?
Think of a membrane as something why? That has this capacity to, under the correct conditions, transport selectively materials from one side to another.
Ah.
So my definition of membrane then is probably old-fashioned.
I guess my definition of membrane is something very thin, very flexible, so have a huge aspect ratio, for example.
Okay, right. So
much, much wider.
So it's like a thin film.
It's a thin film.
As opposed to a membrane seems to me to have rather more special properties.
Okay.
But since you've got this word impermeable membrane, there must be a lot of people that think of it this way.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Think of it as a protective shield.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
So it has been,
just,
for example, proposed to be used as anti-oxidation coating. You only need one layer. It actually protects the material.
But I
from
think
oxidation.
It's pretty hard to make it without a hole here and there.
Native Indian art, right? You always got to leave something that's not perfect. Otherwise, it no longer becomes of any real personable value.
It reminds me of, as I remember reading, I Love History, that fullerenes, buckyballs, have been mm-hmm. found in ancient Chinese inks that are 2,000 years old. So maybe.
Well, soot has been around forever.
Been.
And buckyballs sure. reside in soot.
Yes.
So I would suspect that long ago in China there was graphene floating around somewhere.
Possibly. I think graphite certainly has a very long history.
What was the biggest surprise for you to suddenly become a professor of science in North America compared to the experiences that you know you would have to go through if you were in China? Americans are really worried about their ranking in education. Mm-hmm. Of which all three of us at this table have a responsibility. If you could say, wave a magic wand, what would you do?
Well, U.S. does have the best, I would say, higher education system in the world.
So what is the problem in China? Why don't they have it?
In the past, it was actually simply just the lack of money in the past.
We have a couple of minutes, Jeannie. What do you foresee in the next couple of years in your own research group? The breakthrough that you think you would like to have? Just one.
Well, I would like to see a large gap in graphene, in few-layer graphene, a room temperature gap in few-layer graphene, and that would become useful for semiconductor industry.
We've had our 28 minutes, Jeannie Lau. Thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. Fascinating. Look forward to your results in the future.
Yes, please come back, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And thank you, audience out there. You're getting a lot of physics these days. If you like these programs, let the station know. See you next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. University Medical Center wants county commissioners to approve $162 million in certificates of obligation. The money will allow UMC to build 3 super clinics in El Paso, potentially saving $17 million a year from preventable hospital visits. Commissioners Court is expected to take up the proposal in April. Read more in the region's Life Sciences News Digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.